Israel continues a deadly onslaught on the besieged Gaza Strip with a death toll from U.S.-Israeli genocide rising over 34,000. In Iraqi military base housing PMU resistance fighters comes under a drone attack south of the capital Baghdad. Some Iraqi officials have blamed the strike on Israel. And U.S. police in New York raid a major pro-Palestine sit-in at Columbia University campus, arresting more than 100 students. Israel has launched fresh airstrikes on the city of Rafah in southern Gaza, killing at least 7 people. According to Palestinian media, most of the victims have been women and children. Death toll is likely to rise due to a number of seriously wounded. Attack hit the Tal al-Sultan neighborhood of Rafah, and it comes as the Israeli military is preparing evacuation plans for the city in anticipation of a ground offensive by the regime. Death toll from the Israeli genocide in Gaza now stands at over 34,000 since early October. Thousands are still unaccounted for and presumed buried under rubble. The Israeli war has also caused worsening humanitarian crisis in Gaza, where almost the entire population faces hunger. Our correspondent Mati Abu Musaba joined us earlier from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah with the latest on Israeli strikes.
Yes, actually, the Israeli occupation forces scaled up their airstrikes and attacks against multiple areas in the Gaza Strip, and this began from Rafah City, whereas the Israeli occupation forces committed an alarming massacre against the Palestinian civilians there after the Israeli warplanes carried out an airstrike against a residential apartment in Tal al-Sultan neighborhood, which is known as one of the most densely populated neighborhoods and squares in Rafah City. At least 10 Palestinian civilians, including 6 children and women, were reportedly and tragically killed and murdered over the attack. In the meantime, more Israeli airstrikes hit sporadic areas in the same city, while the western parts and the coastal parts of the city were subjected to heavy gunfire of the Israeli military boats. While when it comes to Khan Yunis city, particularly the surrounding areas of Al-Mawasi area, they were subjected to multiple Israeli airstrikes, knowing that Al-Mawasi also is completely overcrowded with the displaced Palestinians who have been displaced from different areas in Gaza City and the northern part of Gaza Strip, and they are crammed in that area. The Israeli occupation forces repeatedly attacked that area, leaving and causing more death and more Palestinian civilians being killed in that area.
Israeli forces carried out more raids into the occupied West Bank cities of Tukaram and Abira, killing at least 7 Palestinians. A number of Israeli forces were also injured in clashes with resistance fighters in occupied territory. For more details, we're now going to swing over to our Ramallah correspondent, Mona Candiel. Hello, Mona. Hope you're safe and doing well. What can you tell us?
For over 40 hours, unfortunately, the Israeli military is still conducting a military raid in the Nur Shams refugee camp in Tul Karim. During this military raid that is still going on, Israeli soldiers are raiding Palestinians' homes, forcing women and children out of the homes and turning these houses into interrogation centers. At least 7 Palestinians had been wounded this morning. 2 Palestinians were shot and killed last night, including a Palestinian child. Reports coming from the Nur Shams refugee camp, people there are saying that at least 5 more Palestinians had been killed. However, they are confiscated, their bodies are confiscated by the Israeli forces inside the refugee camp of Nur Shams, while the Israeli forces is still preventing Palestinian ambulances from entering the refugee camp of Nur Shams, or to make sure that Palestinians had been killed or not. The Israelis are still operating inside Nur Shams refugee camp and inside the city of Tul Karem, and at the same time, exchange of fire is taking place between the members of the Palestinian resistance groups in the Nur Shams refugee camp, as well with the Israeli forces. Last night, resistance groups were saying that there is a Palestinian called Abu Shuja, the commander of the Tul Karem Brigade, and it's an armed wing of the Saraya al-Quds, was shot and killed. But no official confirmation had been released by the Palestinian Ministry of Health, because as I was saying, the Israeli forces are preventing anyone from entering the refugee camp and to specifically enter this building where the Israelis are still surrounding. During the military raid in Tul Karem, Israeli forces had caused severe destruction in the roads and the infrastructure, the shops there and buildings. They were partially destroyed by the Israeli forces, and the resistance groups issued a statement saying that their fighters succeeded to detonate explosive devices into Israeli vehicles. The Israeli military revealed that at least two soldiers were wounded during this military operation. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, the Israeli forces had raided Beit Rima near Ramallah, this village, and arrested a number of Palestinians. And as we are speaking now, it seems that the Israeli forces had raided the city of Al-Biri, specifically in the Jabal al-Tawil area near the illegal settlement of Pesigod. And as usual, these military operations are meant to conduct arrests among the Palestinians. The exact number of the Palestinians who were arrested had not been revealed yet. In Tul Karem, dozens of Palestinians were detained in the last 40 hours. Here in Ramallah and Biri and the areas in center, the occupied West Bank, at least a dozen of Palestinians were detained as well.
Right, Mona, and if you remember, Mona, last year I remember the new cabinet, Netanyahu's new cabinet, comes into power between January and October 7th. It was a record year when it came to settler attacks in the occupied West Bank. Over 700 attacks. It was the most in, I believe, 20, 25 years in the area. And then comes post-October 7th. And we're on the side of Operation Al-Aqsa Storm. And even before that, if you remember, there's almost nearly daily raids by occupation forces throughout the occupied West Bank. But after October 7th, it became every single day we've seen occupation forces raiding camps inside the occupied West Bank, as well as residential centers of Palestinians. And then they've gotten more violent, and not to mention this wholesale campaign of abducting young Palestinians.
There was no single day without Israeli forces storming Palestinian areas, even before the 7th of October. Every day, Israeli forces were conducting military raids across the occupied West Bank. But the thing that that is different after the 7th of October, when we were speaking about three, four Palestinians being detained on a daily basis, now we are speaking about at least a dozen of Palestinians are being arrested. There is some days over 40 Palestinians were arrested in a single day across the occupied West Bank. And this is why the number of the Palestinians who had been detained only since the 7th of October up till today is over 8,300 Palestinians. And for the first time, we are saying that almost 10,000 Palestinians are being incarcerated behind bars, including women and children, elderly, members of the resistance groups, Palestinian activists, people from all walks of life. In addition to the Israeli forces' military raids, the Israeli settlers are also storming Palestinian areas, raiding the villages, the towns, storming the houses, and burning Palestinian vehicles and properties. It's not something new. We can remind our viewers that the Israeli settlers had once burned a whole family, the Dawabshi family, killed several month-old Ali Dawabshi and his parents, and it was Palestinian child Abu Khudair was also burned by the Israelis. And now the settlers, because all of them, they are armed, they can raid the Palestinian areas knowing they are supported by the Israeli forces, and they continue to commit more crimes against the people here.
That was a very unfortunate. I'll never remember that case, Mona, because they set that family's home on fire. They killed that 18-month-old baby along with his parents. And then guess what? The soldier or the settlers that did that got less than a year in an Israeli jail and then released. We'll talk to you later, Mona. Thank you for that update. Mona Candiel joining us from occupied Ramallah. Meanwhile, tensions remain high along southern Lebanese border, where the resistance movement Hezbollah and Israel have been regularly exchanging fire since October. In the latest incident, the resistance group targeted Israeli positions in the Hadab Yarin with appropriate weapons. Our Beirut correspondent joining us now with more details. Hello, Miriam. Hope you're safe and doing well out there in Beirut. What can you tell us with respect to the latest clashes between the occupation forces regime there and Hezbollah?
Well, like you said, Daniel, the operations here have continued unabated. Hezbollah has proven, especially with the Israeli and U.S. pressure that is being put on Lebanon through diplomatic means, it seems that Hezbollah is adamant on continuing these operations, stressing that this is a separate issue than all the issues that are underlying here in Lebanon with the political challenges and the political conflicts that we have concerning the election of a president and other elections coming up, municipal elections and things like that. And so it seems Hezbollah is continuously basically targeting the Israelis, despite the fact that we have several days where Hezbollah tightens the noose and basically presses ahead with really significant, complex operations. At some times there are routine operations. Today in the early morning, Hezbollah launched, as you said, an operation against the base of Hadab Yarin, and this is one of the bases. And it's a surprise to see that Hezbollah always finds something to target in those bases. Although some of them have been destroyed, their technological devices, their espionage devices, their radars, a lot of them have been destroyed. The Israelis are trying to make shift and try to bring in recent devices. Hezbollah targets them as well. Hezbollah has also targeted a deployment of soldiers in the Mount of Adathir. The Mount of Adathir is one of the series of mountains that are a part of the Jarmuk mountains. These are the highest peaks in all of occupied Palestine, and this is one of those hills that are surrounding the highest peak, and they have been able and succeeded, as they said, in targeting the deployment of soldiers in that area. Now, there is also the issue of the operation in Arab al-Jurmuk, Arab al-Aramisha, excuse me, which is was significant operation recently. We know from Israeli media that at least six Israeli soldiers are still in very, very critical condition in hospital, and despite the fact that there is no disclosure of the number of soldiers, if they were dead or killed, but this was a very significant operation. The Israelis are still pondering on how Hezbollah knew that there was a meeting place and a gathering place for Israeli soldiers in that area specifically, and how Hezbollah was able, through their complex operations of launching both missiles and drones and through their surveillance, to get that intelligence. And so therefore this is a very significant operation. The Israelis are still talking about today, and as we said, Israeli soldiers remain in very critical condition in their hospital. The Israelis of course continue their shelling. Yesterday they reached areas that are closer to the city of Tyre. Today they are bombarding the heart of the towns of Kfar Kila and Ait Ashab. These are residential areas, civilian houses that are being destroyed on a daily basis. And we see that in addition to the fact that they are also launching attacks on the outskirts of the villages. The outskirts of villages sometimes perhaps don't have houses or residential areas, but we have a lot of agriculture fields, and there are a lot of trees that are being destroyed and burned down by the Israeli shelling.
We have breaking news also that Israeli warplanes have struck areas in southern Lebanon as we are speaking. And Miriam, before we let you go, these exchanges, we know they've been restricted for the most part to that area along the southern Lebanese border. But I remember I've spoken to you in the past where you said that the regime is actually hitting targets deeper into Lebanese territory, including a lot of residential areas, resulting in civilian casualties, something we have not seen Hezbollah do, but apparently the Israelis don't have a problem with doing that. Is that still taking place?
It is somewhat taking place, but it's also very evident that the Israelis are also very much limited. Hezbollah has succeeded in prohibiting the Israelis of launching a full-scale war, just launching haphazard shelling all over the civilian areas in Beirut and Bekaa. We notice that the Israelis are hitting very specific targets because it seems that they know, they've learned from their lesson. We have a lot of treaties and agreements back in 1996 when the Israelis knew that every time they targeted civilians, Hezbollah would target deep in the heart of their home front. And so Hezbollah has made it clear they want to keep it limited. If the Israelis do continue with more attacks against civilians, then Hezbollah directly retaliates against areas where there could be settlements, and this could be something very hurting for the Israeli regime. And this is why I believe Hezbollah has succeeded in basically limiting the front of the confrontation in this specific
areas. Miriam, thank you. Stay safe. We'll talk to you soon. Miriam Saleh there updating us out of Beirut. Meanwhile, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it's fired drones at an Israeli position in occupied territories following an early morning attack on an Iraqi military base. The umbrella group of Iraqi resistance factions has released a video of its attack, saying they targeted a key location in occupied port city of Eilat. A strike followed a drone attack on an Iraqi military base in Babylon province. Base is jointly used by Iraqi resistance group known as the Popular Mobilization Units, or PMU, the Iraqi Federal Police, and the Army. Some Iraqi officials have blamed the pre-dawn attack on Israel, although PMU statement said U.S. was behind this incident. According to a chief security official in Babylon province, there were 5 explosions at that base, leaving at least 1 person dead and several others injured. And now U.S. police have detained more than 100 pro-Palestinian students staging a sit-in on a campus at New York's Columbia University. Police clamped down on the protesters and cleared an encampment set up by the students demonstrating against Israel's war on Gaza. Several students involved in the protests are also suspended from the university. They include Isra Hirsi, daughter of the Elon Omar, that's a Democrat in the U.S. House of Representatives. A university professor, Joseph Howley, has criticized the move, saying that the university responded to how the students were protesting rather than what they're protesting for. Meanwhile, the students returned to the school premises in defiance and in protest against the university's policies. Since the onset of Israel's campaign of genocide in Gaza, universities throughout the U.S. have seen a rise in protests and civil disobedience. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Eight deliveries have become known as death traps in the Gaza Strip. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, aid deliveries have become known as death traps in Gaza. Karam al-Shawa understands why. On February 29th, he witnessed the flour bag massacre. The Zionist regime opened fire on Palestinians waiting for food on Al-Rashid Street, southwest of Gaza City, that day. As a result, 118 people were killed. Karam had been among the crowds. He and his friend Muhammad had retreated from the scene once they heard a warning to disperse from an Israeli troop. Soon after they had begun to move away, they saw the Israeli regime military attacking the crowd. The horrific incident convinced Karam that queuing for aid was too dangerous. Yet a few days later, he found himself running toward a place where, according to news spread by word of mouth, flour was available in tons. As his family had nothing left to eat, Karam felt that collecting a small amount of flour was necessary. He said, unfortunately, some of us were too late. I saw people desperately taking some flour from the ground. The flour was mixed with sand, but these people felt it was better to take it than to go back to their families empty-handed. Karam has observed some of the most terrible incidents in the Zionist regime's current genocidal war. His home was near Ashrafa, Gaza's largest hospital. When Israeli regime troops besieged the hospital in March, having previously attacked it on several occasions, Karam felt that he was living through a non-stop nightmare. He was extremely worried about what could happen to his sister and their mother, particularly when the Zionist regime military seized the building across from where they lived. As far as the Al-Shawa family could see, the Israeli regime forces started using that building for coordination purposes during the siege of Ashrafa and its environs. On March 20, the family had an extremely tough night. It was Ramadan, and although they had been fasting all day, they had no appetite in the evening. They just broke their fast with some water and dates, Karam said. The sound of gunfire from the Israeli occupation was deafening. Karam learned that the Israelis had broken into the home of his uncle who lived next door. Manal, Karam's mother, hastily grabbed her own family's cash and jewelry with the aim of hiding it from the Israeli regime forces. The following morning, the family tried to contact Karam's uncle but could not reach him. They then went to his house once they were sure that the Zionist regime troops were no longer in it. Karam said, "I was shocked by the condition of the house. There wasn't a single spot on the walls that didn't have a bullet hole." It took almost a day before the family managed to get any news from Karam's uncle. When the Israelis broke into his home, they ordered that he leave it. Several days later, Israeli regime troops again entered their street in tank. With gunfire nearby, the six family members got down on the floor in their apartment. They crawled between rooms and sought to keep some distance from the windows. Soon the family could hear that the Israeli regime troops had broken into apartments in the same building. The family had heard various pieces of advice about how to respond if faced by Israeli regime troops. The advice was to be submissive or risk fatal consequences. Murad. Karam's father has a good knowledge of Hebrew. He learned the language after making frequent visits to Israel for treatment after being diagnosed with cancer in 2007. When Murad heard that the Zionist regime troops were very close, he stood behind the door and spoke in a loud voice. He said, "We are civilians, a family of six. Myself, my wife, three sons and a daughter. Should I open the door?" After Rad opened the door, the troops took him outside the apartment. They ordered him to sit on the floor with his hands raised. The troops then instructed the other members of the family to leave the apartment one by one. Everyone complied apart from Majed, the eldest son. Majed, who has cerebral palsy, was extremely afraid and refused to move. His father, Rad, tried to tell the troops that Majed has a medical condition. He would not move because of fear, not because he wished to disobey, Rad explained. The troops split the family in two. Majed, his sister Entesar, and their mother were held in the living room. Karam, his younger brother Amr, and their father were taken to the kitchen. "They told us to take off our clothes," Karam said, adding, "A soldier came over to me and took my ID. After a humiliating search, they made us kneel with our hands in the air." The troops went through the apartment. They found a box of spent bullets. The family had collected the bullets from the streets after the Zionist regime forces had carried out an earlier ground invasion. Karam said, "The soldiers aimed their weapons at my father's head, and I was struck with the back of another weapon." The Israeli regime troops accused the family of storing arms for Hamas. Rad, Karam's father, sought to assure them that the bullets were already spent and that they had actually been fired by the Zionist regime troops. But the troops continued to behave aggressively. The Zionist regime troops then tied up the hands of the three men in the kitchen and blindfolded them. They were forced to stand facing the wall for about an hour, during which the troops searched the apartment another time. The men were taken to the first floor of the building. They and members of another family were ordered to hand over their IDs for inspection. Karam was unable to comply with that order because the same troop giving the order had already taken his ID and not returned it. Karam said, "The soldier denied that he had taken the ID and accused me of lying." When the Zionist regime soldier asked Karam for his identity number, Karam could not provide it as he had not memorized it. He had never needed to memorize it previously. The soldier then asked him for his name 10 consecutive times. After Karam had repeated his full name 10 times, the soldier gave him back his ID. Before that moment, the family had resolved to remain in Gaza City. Now they were given no choice than to leave for the south. They were told that they would have to be naked for their waist up as they evacuated. The soldiers tried to claim that the measure was for their own safety. It would make clear to Israeli troops along the way that they were civilians. They were then brought to the entrance of the building. There, they found Karam's brother Majed, along with the female members of their family and a neighboring family sitting on the floor. The Israeli regime troops gave them a number of torches. One of the torches was placed on Karam's head. The troops warned them that they must follow the demarcated route. Deviating from it would result in them being shot.
This one lay. Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. President Ibrahim Raisi says that Iran's retaliatory strikes against Israel were a necessary punitive measure after the regime's deadly attack on the Iranian embassy in Syria. Iranian generals in recent days have warned Israel against making another mistake. Iran says the response to any new Israeli acts of aggression will be considerably stronger. Many observers believe that Iran's Operation True Promise has changed the military equation in the region, and Israel can no longer strike other countries without expecting a response. But the question is, will Israel learn its lesson and heed the warnings of the international community to de-escalate the tensions? We'll discuss that in tonight's Spotlight with our guests. Journalist and writer Sakina Datu joining us from the British capital, London. And also joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, we have journalist and political analyst, Ms. Julia Kassem.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Ms. Datu in London. In your opinion, how successful was Iran's Operation True Promise that was carried out against the Israeli regime? And with that, the failure for the Israelis, which can no longer boast their military superiority, and that goes for the U.S. as well, which could not fully protect Israel.
I think it was hugely successful. I think it wasn't just the fact that Iran was able to strike for the first time a country like Israel for with 300 drones and missiles. And, you know, this is a country that everybody thought was not touchable, that they were invincible. Nobody could, they had the Iron Dome, which protected them, and nobody was able to touch them. Of course, Iran proved that this was not correct. But it wasn't just that act in itself. I think the whole process of how this was planned by Iran was absolutely amazing and successful. I mean, the whole, 10 days before that, playing cat and mouse and hyping up, putting Israel into, an atmosphere of fear, what they have been doing to Palestinians for the past 6 months, experiencing that, not knowing what was coming, and then, of course, giving the notice that they were going to fire these missiles, and the rush by Israel and its all its allies around the world coming together to try and protect Israel. I think Iran played an excellent hand, and they are being looked upon not only here in London and in the rest of the capitals, with a different eye since this has happened, but around the world. I think people are looking up to Iran in a way that was not possible before.
Ms. Julia Kassem in Beirut, the commander of the Iranian Army's ground force, Brigadier General Qumar Seydari, he said the True Promise operation shifted equations in West Asia in favor of Iran. What kind of shifts is he talking about?
First, it was the immediate shift
in the deterrence that was demonstrated by Iran as successfully being able to deter Israel and basically stop it in its tracks of having complete confidence or perceived confidence in, initiating attacks against Iran and having the U.S. Back it in that objective. So Iran successfully deterred the Zionist entity. Two, there was the element of surprise. The U.S. and Zionist entity were in anticipation for 10 days, over 10 days, 13 days following the strikes on the embassy, not knowing exactly when, how, or where the Iranian response would be, which, terrified it and put them on the edge. The third aspect was the strategy and the imbalance, the strategic imbalance that that Iran was able to wage against the Zionist entity by draining 1.3 billion as the air defenses just ran, wreaked havoc in trying to keep up with the hundreds of drones, junk drones, by the way, that Iran sent to keep those air defenses busy, three or four layers worth of air defenses via the Jordanians, via the Americans, and the Zionist entity themselves. And finally, by, sending out the actual missiles that hit the targets of the two air bases at Nevatim, the Ramon Air Base, which hit their targets, as even the Zionist entity itself confirmed. And as Iranian generals have said, that exceeded the expectations of the IRGC in waging this retaliatory operation in response to Israel's attack on the embassy. So this Iranian counterattack was incredibly successful on all fronts. It was able to, like I said, deter Israel. It was able to inflict serious losses upon the Zionist entity, and it was able to really demonstrate the capabilities of the Islamic Republic in waging such a successful strike using older stockpiles entirely. Right now, go ahead.
Ms. Datu, talk to us about the hypocrisy of most of these Western countries that we're seeing, namely the U.S. and the U.K. They were quick to condemn Iran's retaliation, where no civilians were killed, no hospitals or schools were destroyed. And on the other hand, just about every crime imaginable has been committed against the people of Gaza for over 6 months now, but no condemnation for the Israelis over their genocidal rampage that continues as we speak.
You know, the hypocrisy of the West has become so starkly, open and they're out there for anyone to see. It is sometimes embarrassing for us, who are citizens now of these countries, because first of all, for the past 6 months, what we've been watching in Gaza, despite so many efforts to try and spin, what has been going on and to try and confuse, they used to be, if I may say, in the past, they used to be very successful at spinning stories. People here, for example, in the West used to believe them when they would spin around, 99% of the media in the West is owned by Zionists. And therefore, that was the only story that people were hearing. However, first of all, starting with what happened in Gaza and the genocide, people have been watching, footage coming out directly from Gaza. And this changed the equation straight away with how people were viewing things. And then, of course, what happened with Iran. The image of Iran that has been spread, not just here in the West, because the Western media is consumed hugely around the world, not just in the West. So they were very successful in portraying Iran as a very soft target. Iran wasn't very capable. Stories such as those of Mahsa Amini and talking about Iran, not having women's rights. So they put a lot of spin in showing Iran as a country that was not serious, as a country that was not strong. And I think following 6 months of oppression happening in Gaza, people were hurting. People around the world are crying every day about what is happening. They were looking for somebody to come to the aid of people in Gaza. And Iran showed the way, because I think before Iran launched the drones, there was a condition that if the genocide stops in Palestine, there would be no retaliation. So everybody has seen around the world that the only country that has really stood up for the oppressed has been Iran. And then the capability that was showcased, it has changed a lot of things. And now the hypocrisy is not working. They are still trying to spin stories over the year, but I think there are memes going on around the world, and people have made a joke. The story, for example, that has come out yesterday about the fact that there were attacks in Iran and they cannot show any footage for it. This has become a joke worldwide. People are, messaging each other. People are in social media making all these memes to make fun of these Western leaders. And Israel has completely lost, I think, face around the world.
Ms. Qasem, how do you see the massive global support for Iran's retaliatory operation, the support that Iran received for basically shattering Israel's myth of invincibility, minus the U.S. and other accomplices of the Israelis? Almost all regional countries have expressed support for what Iran carried out.
Yeah, so as the image of the Zionist entity has really plummeted and shattered in light of its genocide over the past 6 months, the aftermath of Iran's retaliatory strike, it was obvious that there was a lot of public reception that viewed the Islamic Republic's action very positively, mainly for two reasons. One is that Iran acted within the complete bounds of international law, aside from the fact that it is internationally enshrined right to respond in the first place to the attack on its diplomatic facility. It responded just within the bounds of international law, and it was able to launch all of these drones and missiles, hit their targets appropriately, exceed the military equation that they set out for, without even having to go into, battle full on, without, killing any civilians, and without inflicting any damage on non-combatant locations. So people noticed that this really heightened the contradictory hypocrisy that Israel and its Western backers keep on saying when they try to justify the mass civilian deaths as collateral damage from quote-unquote targeting Hamas. So this exposed their hypocrisy while showing a diplomatic, ethical way of reaching some kind of military objective. And two, people definitely saw it first and foremost as a action done in support of the Palestinian people. Even before Iran struck, it even was able, it even was willing to give up, its right to respond in exchange for a permanent ceasefire. But even in the aftermath, Iran was basically aimed to use counterattack and also the threat of a stronger one should Israel strike again as leverage to support the Palestinian people and as leverage to stop this genocide. Of course, the U.S. on Israel's behalf is trying to, in the event of quieting down any kind of potential for another stronger Iranian response, begged Iran to allow Israel to do a quote-unquote symbolic strike, which is what we saw with the quadricopter floating over Esfahan via internal agents from the MEK. But, of course, this effort essentially will fit. In exchange for that, this was also wanted to continue the genocide in Rafah that it opposed before, the invasion. So Iran also, had a its diplomatic higher ground was, and as well as its moral higher ground, was exceptionally clear in this context of both its leverage that it was able to and aimed to kind of impose, as well as the ethics that it adhered to in the face of a very unethical enemy.
Ms. Datu, let's focus on the U.S. response now to Iran's retaliation. Washington warned Israel not to act against Iran. And if the Israelis did act, they would be on their own and the U.S. would not support them. That seems quite different from the usual U.S. Threats and rhetoric against Iran. We remember the infamous all options on the table threat that the U.S. would basically throw around on a weekly basis. What has changed now? Is the U.S. even now realizing that attacking Iran is out of the question?
I would take that with a pinch of salt. I think, you know, the support of American support for Israel is really deeply, you know, intertwined. So I wouldn't say that they wouldn't support them going forward and that they have completely ruled out attacking Iran anytime. What is happening right now, all these statements that you hear are geared towards the elections that are coming up this year. This is the same in the US and also in the UK. What has really happened is that the masses in these Western countries have really shown support for Palestine and completely, you know, the dynamics have changed completely. We've been looking at processions happening at the moment in U.S. everywhere, in New York and, you know, sit-ins that are happening. And with the elections coming up, I mean, Biden is very, very nervous that if he continues to show war-mongering, you know, continue to, and if at all, they were to support Israel to make an attack on Iran and therefore escalation going into possibly a third, you know, World War III, he would never win this election. And I think, therefore, this is just politicking for now. On the other hand, they've also lost a lot of moral ground around the world. I think this is a time when they probably want to pull back and try to, you know, regroup themselves, because around the world they've got no support. We saw what happened at the UN Security Council, you know, when the vote for a Palestinian state was being held. 12 countries were in support of that. It was only the UK and Switzerland that abstained, and of course America, as usual, vetoed. But you, I mean, the it is very obvious around the world that now there is a huge shift. All the countries, you know, some countries in Africa, in Arab countries, they wanted to sign this in the Arab countries Abrahamic Accord before, and in Africa, a lot of countries were already compromised because of investment from Israel going into Africa, and therefore were supporting. But following what has now happened, first of all, the ongoing genocide, but also the Iranian attack, the world has once again changed completely and shifted away from Israel. And America is aware of this. They are looking very isolated. And I think, you know, politics and global view and what, you know, the image that has been portrayed, these are the reasons why America is using these kind of statements. I mean, I would not put it beyond them going forward after the elections to consider warmongering again, because this is what they survive on.
Ms. Qasem, Israel has been a menace to all countries around it, like Lebanon and Syria, where Israel constantly violates their sovereignty and carries out illegal strikes on a regular basis. But Iran has said that, quote, the era of Israeli hit and run is over. Has Iran now set a precedent, in your opinion, where these countries will now respond to Israeli attacks and the Israeli regime's destabilizing actions?
Absolutely. I mean, we've already seen the resistance, you know, across the Lebanese Hezbollah front, across the Ansarullah front, across the Iraqi resistance front, you know, constantly strike at the Zionist entity over the past 180, 190 plus days. But right now, what we see is a counterattack waged by Iran that really stops the impunity of the Zionist entity in its tracks. One, the Zionist entity is definitely going to reconsider its perspective that it could just wage any kind of act of aggression and just thinks that the whole world will be able to follow along. That's been shattered. You know, the perception of unconditional support, not necessarily due to any kind of moral means by the Western powers, as Israel is essentially an extension of their objectives and policies, but of the extent of its arrogance that have clouded its own judgment, that the West is realizing is really just backfiring on it. So this is in addition to the second dimension, which is the demonstrated capabilities of Iran in just one retaliatory strike alone, which also has Zionist entity second-guessing itself. So in those respects, yeah, we can definitely say that that this has changed the equation in terms of deterrence, as we were saying earlier, in terms of capabilities of the Zionist entity versus Iran's, especially after the symbolic strike, quote unquote, that Israel tried to use with the mini quadrocopters yesterday. But right now, definitely in terms of putting a stop to the just the rogueness of the Zionist entity whenever either wants to pull the U.S. into a further escalation and draw the resistance powers into its trap, or if it just wants to achieve its aims without any regards to battlefields or any conventions on the rules of war. The Qasem Soleimani, the assassination of Pasha Qasem Soleimani in 2020 was just an example of its hit-and-run style. The attack on the embassy just a few weeks before, a couple weeks almost before the retaliatory attack by Iran. So yes, this has really also been a turning point in the Zionist entity's hit-and-run attacks. Sure. That it has constantly waged.
Ms. Datu, we've been talking about Operation True Promise changing a lot of equations in the region. Can Iran's retaliation impact Israel's genocidal war on Gaza? Because at the end of the day, the main objective right now for regional countries is to stop the genocide in Gaza and see an immediate ceasefire.
I think, you know, it will end the genocide in Gaza, but it's probably going to take a bit more time, because I think, you know, at the moment Israel is feeling very bruised, and they have to show not just to their people but to the world that they are achieving something. Now, obviously, you know, they have failed on every front, but they need to keep some sort of a face to show that they are winning. And therefore, I fear that because of that feeling of being a wounded animal, they might even go further and attack into Rafah. And this can be catastrophic, as we know, for Palestine. So I would like to be hopeful, but I don't think that, again, Netanyahu, as we know, he's looking for survival. If the war ends right now, he's wanted for corruption charges, and therefore his career is over. And he wants to prolong this war. Of course, his initial plan was to try and escalate by trying to hit countries like Iran, and now he's been slapped, and he knows that he can't go that route. So the only people he can continue to oppress are the oppressed people of Palestine, who do not have any kind of weapons on their own. They cannot defend themselves, and the resistance, of course, is assisting, but I do fear that we might see a worse situation before it gets better. But this is like coming to an end of the Zionists. You know, there is just so much they can do at the end of the day. Every sign shows of a country that is collapsing. People are leaving. The settlers who have been coming in, we're seeing in drones, people are leaving. The idea that Israel at one point used to be a safe haven for Jews, that has been shattered. So I think it's on its last legs. But before it goes out, there is a lot more damage I think it will do before it just goes down.
All right, so we're going to leave it there. Thanks to my guests for tonight's program, journalist and writer Sakina Datu joining us from the British capital, London, and thanks to journalist and political analyst Julia Qasem joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, and a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering the doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Call of Islam page, well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program, and the special guest speaker for today's discussion is Shaykh Rouhani. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
All right, Shaykh Rouhani, for today's discussion, we want to talk about Iran's support for Palestinians and the people and the children of Gaza. Some people might ask that Iran and Islamic Republic of Iran is a Shiite land and they follow Shia Islam. Whether we can say Palestinians and the people of Palestine are Sunni ones. Why a Shiite land is helping a Sunni one, and why so many of the Sunni lands, we can say, are silent regarding the oppressions and the atrocities that are taking place by the Zionist regime in Palestine. What would be the answer, Sheikh?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, within Islamic, let's say, Ummah and nation, we have two main theological school. One is Adliya, who believe in Adala of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and justice of God. And there is the opposite of this is the idea that they do not believe in the divine justice.
Okay.
So Shia and Mu'tazila are the two main schools or theological school in Islam who believe in Adl, in justice of God as well as justice of the human being. So performing justice and fulfilling justice in our, let's say, religious life is something that is that among the main or the principal belief of tashayyu. Shia Muslims believe in there are five main principles of Islam according to Shia. The first one is Tawheed, the second one is Adala.
Yes.
This Adala requires